Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Welcome back to Newsweek Radio. I'm Jesse Edwards, and if you've been paying attention to the news lately coming out of Russia, and China for that matter, you're going to want to pay attention to our next guest, Calder Walton. He's the author of Spies, the Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. Calder, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
So I'm sure you were glued to the television over this last weekend, like we all were, wondering what the heck was going on with Wagner and this Prigozhin guy rushing into Moscow. We all thought we were going to see a bloody battle. What happened?
I think that you used the right phrase, what the heck happened? And like everyone else, I'm trying to figure it out. It's difficult to find up from down, I have to say. There are precedents, it seems to me, of where we are. It has a lot of echoes with the 1991 failed coup that against Gorbachev at the final stages of the Soviet Union. That coup looked like it didn't work, but about 4 or 5 months after the coup, the entire Soviet system collapsed. Is that the direction that we're going to be going in with Putin's regime? Could well be. We don't know the future, of course, but there are different scenarios. I'll tell you what I'm worried about as I've been looking at this. It seems to me that we're in very dangerous territory. A wounded dictator is a very dangerous dictator. And whatever else this weekend's events were, they have definitely weakened and damaged Putin. Will he try to lash out to become the strong man that he professes to be? Ukraine being the obvious bogeyman, scapegoat for doing so, I think that is entirely logical and realistic, I'm afraid to say.
Can you speculate as to how you stop a convoy of 25,000 mercenaries without a shot fired, basically? I mean, I know there were shots fired, but it wasn't, there was no actual conflict. How did they just stand down? Did Putin call them and say, I'm going to kill all your families if you don't stop now?
That seems to be, according to some press reports over the weekend, that was certainly one of the principal threats, was holding his family and the leaders of Wagner's leadership to hostage. You would have thought that Prigozhin would have already thought about that before launching this. And the key aspect is that you would have thought that he would have the backing of at least some of the oligarchs in Moscow and or within the security service, the FSB, the one of the key power brokers in Moscow. You would have thought that he would have had some backing. Maybe the backing that he thought he had didn't materialize as events were unfolding. And that's what we witnessed as his column of troops marched towards Moscow, but then turned back. I'm afraid we just don't know. But I will say that it seems to me entirely likely that U.S. intelligence and other Western intelligence agencies do know what was going on. Because one thing's for certain, in a state of confusion, when things are happening quickly, forces on the ground tend to make mistakes about secure communications. And that is a bonanza for foreign intelligence collection. So I would say that the NSA and GCHQ, Britain's eavesdroppers, would have been all over this. So they will know what was going on. We don't know, but we will know in the course of time when records become available.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Now, just backing up all the way to, you know, the invasion of Ukraine in the first place, this has exposed Putin and Russia as definitely a much weaker force than a lot of us had kind of assumed. We thought they would sort of clean house a little bit quicker than they have. Has it been worth it for Putin and Russia to even try this?
Has it been worth it? It seems emphatically no. Now, I agree entirely with what the director of the CIA, William Burns, said near the outset of the war. This is a war that Putin cannot afford to lose. He has nailed his reputation to it. And that is what makes me very worried about the future. Given that scenario, I just don't, and, you know, the so-called exit roads or off ramps, I just don't see him being able to say, do you know what? This was a mistake. And actually, let's just forget about it. I just don't see that happening. So to answer your question, was it a mistake for Putin himself and Russia? Yes, emphatically. Was it to be expected that he'd make this mistake? And your question hits on something that I think is really important. After 2016, with the Russian election meddling in the United States in the presidential election, there was a tendency in some commentary to regard Russian intelligence as sort of able to pull off these extraordinary coups. And certainly 2016, without straying into the actual impact that the election meddling had, because that's essentially unquantifiable, but certainly we know from bipartisan investigations, intelligence investigations, that Russia had this policy to interfere in the US election in 2016, unambiguously. But actually, if you look at Putin's rule over the last two decades, he has presided over a succession of intelligence failures. Now, he makes much of his Soviet KGB past, but if you scratch the surface, in fact, apparently, I'm told, reliably told by CIA people I interviewed for my new book, that in fact, his KGB career wasn't anything like the sort of the heroic one that he later proclaimed. I've been reliably told that he tried to become a KGB deep cover illegal, operating under deep cover overseas, but he failed the language exam. So this is, from the outset, not quite the intelligence man that he professes to be. Now, he's presided over a succession of intelligence failures. In 2010, a network of Russian deep cover illegals was wound up in the United States. This was a humiliation for Putin. He has failed in 2018. His military intelligence service spectacularly failed to assassinate an MI6 spy in Britain, Sergei Skripal. But the biggest mistake, the one that he will go down in history for, is his gamble about Ukraine. And it seems quite clear already, even though we don't have at least known Russian defector to tell us what was going on, or indeed any Russian records yet, but I'm confident that we will do one day. It seems clear that this was a colossal intelligence failure presided over by Putin himself. Your listeners will remember the bizarre National Security Council meeting on the eve of the invasion, where he essentially one of the people he humiliated on TV was the director of his Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, Sergei Naryshkin. Now, this is because Putin's form of government, as an autocrat and now dictator, has relied on intelligence that confirms his view of the world, not challenges it. This is straightforward echoes from the Soviet past, particularly with the great Soviet, infamous Soviet dictator, Stalin, who, as we can now see from records, only ever wanted to have intelligence that confirmed his existing worldview, not that which challenged it. And it seems that it's straightforward continuum with Putin today. I would rank Putin's failure in Ukraine equivalent to Stalin's mishandling of intelligence before the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, one of the worst intelligence failures in modern history.
Your new book, Spies, The Epic Intelligence War Between East, and West uncovered a plot recently to assassinate somebody within the United States in Miami. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes. This was in relation to the Deep Cover Illegals network that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
The person, the CIA agent spy who gave the US authorities that intelligence about that network was understandably relocated to the United States and given US citizenship. And according to press reporting, has been living in Florida. Now, when I discovered this, one thing became quite clear, that the significance of the story was not actually about the target himself, who has been trying to get on with his own life and to keep away from the murderous intentions of Putin's regime. Rather, the significance of the story was what Putin was prepared to do, cross this bright red line, which had existed throughout the Cold War and had up until apparently been in place up until this point in 2020. And that bright red line was that Russian intelligence and Soviet intelligence before it would not conduct assassinations on the US soil. Europe and Britain were different matters, but not in the US. And Putin, we now know, was prepared to do exactly that. This, it seems to me, is sort of fits into an escalation of Putin's risk-taking towards the West. The big question that I would like to your colleagues who are investigative journalists, it's not my field, I'm a mere historian, but it seems to me that the big questions that need resolving from this story is what were the actual actions and responses taken by the US government? Were they robust enough? Were they adequate to give Putin a real sense of a bloody nose when he was prepared to do this?
What was our response?
My understanding was that our response was inadequate. Some expulsions of diplomatic officials, intelligence officers undercover. That's my understanding.
What kind of assassination are we talking about here? Like a polonium sandwich situation? Was this person in witness protection or anything?
He wasn't in witness protection. I do not know what the nature of the assassination was. Hmm. So it was, all I know for certain is that it was in late stage planning and was about to commence, but I do not know the nature of the assassination. My understanding is that the response from first the Trump administration and then the Biden administration was less than robust, let's put it that way. But this is an area for investigative journalists to investigate, and I hope your colleagues are going to do so. The big question for me is, if that is the case, and if it was less than a robust response, did that less than robust response feed into Putin's risk calculation about Ukraine? That, I think, is the huge question that needs to be really studied.
So what's Putin's endgame here with Ukraine? Is he just going to declare victory and pull out eventually like we did in Afghanistan? Or
I don't see him doing that. I really don't. I don't. As I said, I agree with what Bill Burns said, which is that this is a war that Putin cannot lose. Now, quite what losing means is in the eye of the beholder. So, of course, in the kind of Kremlin doublespeak, where up is down and so on and so forth, you can probably make a victory out of a defeat. But once he's gone so far as, you know, from the outset to say that Ukraine doesn't exist as an independent nation, I don't really see where the middle ground for compromise is. You know, the analogies that come to my mind is some sort of frozen conflict, like perhaps Korea in the 1950s, where both sides are unhappy with the result, but it is at least a result. That's where history would suggest we're going. But then again, events are moving so quickly, as you said in the outset, Putin may well get swept aside in the coup or indeed assassinated. I have my own misgivings about what would come next. For Russia and what that means for the U.S., but that is certainly one possibility.
I'm assuming you'll say that he's going to be replaced by somebody even worse.
That's indeed my fear, is that we would hope that someone like Navalny would somehow get out of prison, or Vladimir Karamurza, and come to the rescue, and a true opposition leader. Within the bounds of what is realistic possibilities, I'm afraid I don't see that happening. I see it more likely that someone from the same group that Putin already surrounds himself with will take power. And these are the so-called men of force. If we end up with Putin being overthrown and somebody like Nikolai Patrushev on his security council, another KGB old hand, similarly involved in borderline mafia activities in the 1990s. If someone like Patrushev takes over, or indeed the head of the FSB at the moment, we're going to be in exactly the same situation as Putin. They share his outlook about Ukraine. They come from the same background. And I fear there won't be much difference. It might even be worse, because they may well have clearer heads on their shoulders in terms of their military strategy. So that's my, I'm afraid, rather pessimistic, but I fear realistic view on what might come next after Putin.
Do you think, like in the information age, are decisive victories possible in modern warfare?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, we haven't had the simple answer is we don't know. We haven't had a land war in Europe, since the Second World War. So we are in new territory, because this war, albeit in the new modern digital age, as you've just suggested, it at the same time, it has so many echoes with past wars. Who would have thought, 3 years ago, that we would be having a war with tanks, and the sights that we're seeing coming out of Ukraine, the same places, for goodness sake, as the Second World War. Some of the footage looks like it's just out of the Second World War. So although our world has changed beyond recognition in the last two decades, thanks to the digital revolution, this war feels very 20th century. So I'm confident to say that we'll be looking at a 20th century outcome in one way or another.
Pivoting over to China for just a moment and zooming out to the global scene, are we on the precipice of World War III?
Well, I look at it in a slightly different way, which is a debate. At least that was had 2 years ago, 3 years ago in policymakers of, are we in a new Cold War? And my answer to that is, in terms of intelligence and national security, absolutely we're in a new Cold War with China. And we should all, as your question suggests, we should all hope that it remains cold and does not turn hot. My own view is that the same circumstances that dictated the last century's Cold War, mutually assured destruction, that's to say that both sides have nuclear weapons capable of incinerating the planet, sure, that still holds today with the United States and China. So we're still determined by MAD, MAD, mutually assured destruction. So just as Reagan said, a nuclear war cannot be won and therefore must never be fought. I strongly still believe that's the case with China.
What do you make of these cat and mouse games down there in the South China Sea? Is this just a playful provocation, or is this something we should really be concerned about? Because it seems to be escalating.
It is escalating. And to what end goal, I don't know. You're absolutely right, it's escalating. This is both sides testing each other, both sides pushing. This is China, as they see it, looking to contain U.S. influence in Southeast Asia. And the U.S., we see it as trying to contain China's influence on the global stage to challenge us and supplant the US. So both sides, in a sort of classic way, just like the Soviet Union in the 20th century during the Cold War, both sides were convinced that they were trying to contain the other. And the same is true with China today. So what is the end game of those provocations? They seem to be provocations at this point. But within those provocations, there are illustrations of China's grand strategy. The intelligence apparatus that, that China is marshalling in the South China Sea and then closer to home with the news that China's apparently opening eavesdropping collection base in Cuba. This is all part of the Chinese Communist Party's overall grand strategy to collect as much intelligence as possible on the US and really the rest of the world with a view to supplanting the US as number one on the world stage.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
So why does Biden send Secretary of State Blinken over to China to meet with Xi Jinping just to come home and turn around and call him a dictator? Doesn't it seem like they're contradicting themselves at this point if diplomacy was actually the end goal?
It certainly does, I'm afraid to say. I don't know what was, that does not seem to be a good communications policy on the White House between that one, between Blinken's trip and Biden's messaging. I think that Blinken's trip to China is absolutely the right thing to do. Again, as history shows, that it's precisely at those moments of crisis when negotiations are most important, either overt, like Blinken did, or covert. I would also be confident to say that when one day records come out about this time that we're living through right now, we'll find out that there were back-channel communications going between the White House and Beijing, even as tensions ratcheted up. But to your question, it certainly was an unedifying spectacle to see Biden say that immediately after some bridge building by his Secretary of State.
Well, Calder Walton, thank you so much for joining us. His book is Spies, the Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. Hey, thanks for your time, and we'll be sure to have you back as these new stories develop.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And that was Calder Walton, author of Spies, the Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. If you like this conversation, be sure to head over to iTunes and give us your 5-star rating with a kind review. We'd appreciate it. For Newsweek Radio, I'm Jesse Edwards.